So on today's podcast, I speak to Dr. Geoffrey Sperling about his career path into Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, his research, specifically around the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health checks, and navigating Indigenous health as a non-Indigenous doctor.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
So today, listeners, we've got the lovely Dr. Geoffrey Sperling, who's joining us today. Geoff works at the Inala Centre of Excellence as one of the senior doctors there, and he's also a senior lecturer in primary care clinical unit at the University of Queensland. Welcome, Geoffrey.
G'day, Danielle. Great to be here.
Well, I hope it is good for you, because I'm sure it'll be good for me. Little story about Geoffrey and I was actually Geoffrey's favourite medical student when I was on practice. He loved teaching me about evidence-based medicine, and from there I've developed a deep love of it. It's not really true, but I am trying, Geoff, aren't I?
Oh, you're one of my greatest students, greatest achievements.
Oh, thanks, Geoff. Apart from my daughter, who was also one of his medical students, so there's always a bit of
competition. That's true. It's a real toss-up there.
I know. Thanks. All right, Geoff. So I'd love to hear about your story and how you ended up working in an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health.
Oh, well, it took a while for me to decide to do GP training in the first place, I guess. I think I was worried that suburban general practice wouldn't interest me that much. The rural stuff certainly did. I'd just come back from working in Honduras, back to Brisbane. I'd been working in Honduras with Médecins Sans Frontières, and I was feeling kind of restless and wanted to continue to work in an area where my skills were most needed and fulfill my concerns about social justice, and also really wanted to work in a high-quality general practice. And I looked around, and the university general practice at Inala seemed to really fit this bill. I'd been there as a med student. And I started there as a trainee, and that's where I first met Dr. Noel Heyman. He's one of the first Aboriginal medical graduates from UQ, and he just had this energy about him that was kind of irresistible. And back in those days, it was 2003, he was just working out of a couple of rooms, but he'd just gotten hold of some funding to employ a full-time GP, and he asked me if I wanted a job because I'd done some research sessions for him. And I went home and talked to my partner about it in 24 hours or so, and came back and said yes, and I haven't really looked back, and he hasn't been able to get rid of me.
No. Yes.
And, so I think I really had a lot to learn in terms of both general practice as a registrar, but also as a on a sort of cultural awareness journey, I guess, on a way to being relatively culturally safe. And I guess in that space, I've come to accept that I'm probably always going to make some mistakes. Hopefully, they're a bit smaller and less frequent these days, but it certainly keeps you humble. And I think in that context, it's really important to have a cultural mentor who you can bounce ideas off. So I've had Dr. Noel, but also the head nurse back in those days, Nola White, was pretty awesome. She knew the community really well, and an Aboriginal woman, and she was really good to ask about patients, and certainly some of the interactions I needed some help with.
And I think we might drill into those sort of interactions later on, because I think it'll be a really good teaching moment for our listeners.
Sure.
So it sounds like it's been a passion of yours to, you know, be there to help people, and, you know, working in Honduras. Tell us a bit about your work there. What were you doing there?
So it was a bit of an unusual mission project for MSF. It was working in Chagas disease, and which is an unusual sort of parasitic infection you only get in Central and South America, and you only get it if you live in fairly poor quality housing with a straw roof. Mm. And this affected the indigenous people in Honduras, actually, in the Central Mountains. And the government had been turning a blind eye or ignoring the problem. And there were WHO sanctioned solutions, so spraying the houses to get rid of all the insects that transmit the bug gets rid of the problem. And so MSF was there to spray all the houses, and my job was to detect all the children and get treatment to them to stop them growing up with heart problems and bowel and intestinal problems. And so, yeah, it involved a lot of travelling around and a lot of I had a social worker who came with me, so a local woman, who helped me sort of talk to the Indigenous people, because obviously it's a different, completely different language. It wasn't even Spanish on many occasions. And so it's just a real, it was really interesting cultural experience. So there was my culture that I was bringing, and then there was my social worker's culture, who was sort of more mainstream Honduras, I suppose. And then you had the Indigenous people we were actually treating. So it was pretty interesting from that point of view.
And so, you know, that it sounds like that work that you were doing, that really important work, has laid a pathway into what you're doing now. And I understand, Jeff, that you've been doing a lot of research around ways that we can improve Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. Can you share a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I guess one of the great things about working for Noel is that he's into teaching, and also research. He's a big proponent of research, and I'd always been interested in evidence-based medicine, just because, like, I guess I was interested in how knowledge is constructed. Like, we make all these decisions in clinical practice, and, you know, I've always been curious about where they came from. But research in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health led me to a PhD, and I was kind of interested in how health assessments could be improved, and also how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health assessments collect a lot of data, so you can use that data to improve health services and argue for different services that are needed, like dental, for example. Mm. But as far as my PhD work went, I thought maybe I should actually be asking the community what they think the priorities are. And as a doctor, when I think about the health priorities for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, or certainly before my PhD, my biomedical mind had settled on things like cardiovascular disease and diabetes and renal failure and smoking and alcohol. And I think a lot of doctors listening to this would probably come to similar conclusions. But the really surprising thing was that these weren't priorities so much for community members. They were mentioned. It's not that they weren't priorities, but their primary priorities were all about education, employment, housing, you know, social determinants of health, experiences of racism, connection to country and the community and culture, and social and emotional well-being was front and center. So it was really quite a confronting experience, and one of the great things about doing a PhD and that sort of research, because, you know, I'd worked in that clinic for over 10 years as a doctor, and I'd basically failed to predict the community's health priorities, which needed to be much more holistic and much less biomedical. My impression is that as you first-year med students still get social determinants of health, but that understanding seems to be driven out of you by the need to learn the whole biomedical language as a medical student and doctor, and you can forget about that as you grow up.
And it's really interesting, because as an Indigenous doctor, that sort of language has always been part of my consult, because for me that social and emotional wellness is really important as well. So I love that you're coming from a biomedical framework and you're actually recognising that we need to be acknowledging that in not only Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients, but perhaps all of our patients.
Yeah, but it wasn't easy. Like, my supervisors will tell you that I was sort of dragged kicking and screaming to this. And it was actually, I'd sort of like, really? So I was like getting to grips with this. And then I read the National Aboriginal Health Strategy, which was the first national strategy put forward for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health back in 1989. And they talk about the Aboriginal definition of health. And it's all about this holistic stuff. And it's like, well, this is what, you know, my community members are saying, and that aligns with what was said all those years ago by Aboriginal people from all around the country. So, you know, clearly I need to wake up and accept this is, you know, this is a really real thing. And it's, you know, yeah, because I think as a doctor you're sort of always told that you're right and privileged and all the rest of it. But actually, yeah, there's times when humility is really important. And so as a result of that, we now ask a lot of those sort of social determinants, or many more of them, in health checks. So we ask about stresses and discrimination and education history, and also some of the, you know, powerful things like participation in community events that actually promote health. And it has changed the conversation a bit. So you're talking about the type of thing that goes on in your consultation. I think hopefully many of the non-Indigenous doctors in our service are now having more of those sorts of conversations. And I think that then means a better understanding of where patients are coming from, but also, you know, more awareness of the referral strategies, you know, for support and things like that.
So maybe we should just backtrack a bit and just talk a bit around, we're saying the word health assessment, but for new registrars, they mightn't be aware of what that is. So Jeff and I are talking about the health in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health assessment, which is also commonly referred to as a 715, which is the MBS item number. Jeff, do you want to talk a bit about how you do 715s in your practice and then what the health outcomes? And then I'm interested in whether the research that you've done and you've been obviously applying what you've been learning from the community into your consults, and, you know, are you starting to see that that's making an impact on the health of your community that you're treating?
So we've only been doing it for a couple of years, and we haven't had a huge amount of opportunity to sort of see any impact of it. Mm-hmm. We'd have to do sort of some
research
around that, I guess. But so health checks came out in 99 originally for people over 55 who are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, and over 70 if you weren't Indigenous. And then NACHO, the peak body in Australia, said, look, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's average life expectancy is about 55, so it's a bit late to be doing a health check then. And health checks were introduced for adults from 15 upwards in 2004, and then kids across the lifespan in 2007. And, it's basically asking about demographics and biomedical things, and it's a way of spending time. So you get, you know, $212 or thereabouts to really spend the time to go through all the preventative health stuff that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people need, I guess, to be healthy. But what we've changed in Inala is to also talk about other aspects of health that aren't in the sort of classic biomedical mold that doctors would be used to. So there's a little bit of resistance when we first started putting these questions in. It's like, well, you know, is that really something we should be asking about? And what are we going to do with the answers? Common things. But I think people have become much more understanding of the importance of it. And I think I've been surprised, and I think other doctors have been surprised that patients don't jack up about it. It's us. It's the doctors who feel uncomfortable about it. I mean, the patients seem to just get that we would be asking these things. Well, of course you would. It's a health check. Mm. But as doctors, it was, you know, quite alien and different. Mm. Hopefully it's resulted in more, better rapport, but also sort of more appropriate referral, better picking up of social emotional wellbeing issues. There's a psychological distress scale developed by an Aboriginal man, Dr. Alex Brown, a doctor from South Australia. And we participated in a trial here in Inala that validated that scale. So we're using that in health checks, the Adapted Patient Health Questionnaire 9. And hopefully we're doing a better job of picking up people with suicidal ideas and depression and anxiety and things like that as a result of using that scale.
Hmm.
But it's a bit hard to know for sure at the moment.
Yeah, I think that that's really important for our listeners to understand that, in communities we talk a lot around grief fatigue, for instance. So you constantly have people in your community or in your family who are dying or who are, you know, in trouble with the police or having issues at home. And it's just one thing after another after another. And that's, you know, they might come in presenting with, you know, for their diabetes check, and we actually don't ask about those things. We don't say, hey, what's going on for you at home? And people are really struggling. You know, unfortunately, my father just recently passed away and sort of 6 weeks ago, and me struggling with the grief has been quite an interesting process because, you know, when I'm helping a patient with it, you're like, oh, well, you know, you're okay. Time heals all wounds, you know, all those sorts of things. But when you're actually digging through it and then something else comes on top of it, you almost feel like you're drowning and you're like, well, how can I keep going? You know, where do I find that strength and resilience from? And I think that's what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have just grown up with, is to learn how to be really resilient. But sometimes you can only be resilient for so long. And so I think it's really important, really powerful for doctors to be able to tap in and almost hold space for people to explore, you know, what is going on in your life and then working out how can I help you. So I think that's the really important thing around a 715 check, is that for listeners who don't know, it actually opens up equivalent to an EPC visit for a GP management plan. So you actually get 5 extra visits. That could be extra on top of a chronic disease like condition. So, you know, then you're actually able to direct people's care and really help them heal. And that's what it's about, I think, when we're talking about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. It's a journey of healing. And I think that the word healing is quite scary for some doctors because it encompasses the whole of a person.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm really sorry to hear about your father, Danielle. I think you know, that would be really difficult.
Thanks, Jeff.
And, yeah, I mean, grief is one of the things that we now ask about specifically, and certainly during the interviews I did with community members, that was something that came up quite a bit, that, you know, funeral after funeral people would talk about. And I think in the past I'd sort of just, you know, almost treated it as a social event, like, oh, yeah, you went to a funeral. But, yeah. Like, you know, now I hear it, and I really hear it, I think. I hear it not just in my head, but sort of, you know what it really means for the person, and how that could be having a really sort of draining impact, and then to go to another one and then another one. And yeah, it's, as you say, it sort of feels overwhelming.
And then just watching like different family members, how they react to grief as well. And then as a parent, you know, observing my children, and, you know, I could imagine in a community when if you've got little kids who are sort of experiencing, you know, recurrent grief, then what's that, you know, doing? Or, you know, the woman who's pregnant and she's going through grief, what's the impact epigenetically on her developing baby? You know, like, that's really interesting research, I think, that's coming out now around epigenetics, grief and depression. I think there was some research my sister was talking about, wasn't she, about the Jewish Holocaust survivors and how we're seeing the epigenetic flow through from the grandchildren of the people who are in the Holocaust and the impact of them. And that's what I talk to my registrars about, is looking at how depression, anxiety, grief will all impact on us epigenetically as well and physiologically.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think the stress, there's a lot of evidence around the stress in those first 1,000 days from when you're conceived until you're 2 years of age. So it's really important to reduce stress in people's lives around that time, I think, and other times as well, of course.
Mm. And that's why, Jeff, I really appreciate the work you're doing, because I actually think it's so important to start talking to doctors about asking all of those broad questions. Now I'm just going to do a little segue just to get you to talk a bit around the PBS listing for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So the 715, could you talk a little bit around Close the Gap as well for people, listeners who don't know?
Okay, so there's a Closing the Gap initiative, I guess, in primary care, where I think this is what you're asking me to talk about, where people can be signed up for a practice incentive payment if they've done some cultural awareness training as a practice, then they can sign up their Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients, which generates a payment that's not insignificant. I can't remember exactly how much it is. And then if you do a health check and they've got chronic disease and you do a GP management plan and a review, you get an extra $1,000 on top of what you were doing anyway. So that's pretty awesome. But one of the best benefits of signing people up for PIP is that patients at risk of chronic disease, which is a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, unfortunately, are entitled to Closing the Gap being put on their scripts, which means that if you've got a healthcare card, the script is covered by the PBS, it doesn't cost you anything. And if you don't have a healthcare card and you've only got Medicare, then it's reduced to the price you would have paid if you had a healthcare card, so about $6 something. So it's really revolutionised the adherence, I guess, of our patients to medications, because cost has become much less of a barrier.
Yes.
In the past, you know, if you're on 3 or 4 medications and you're working and perhaps in a factory job, or you're holding a sign on the road or something like that, then you might not have been earning very much money, but your medications were costing over $100 a month, which is really unsustainable, and people just weren't taking them.
Yeah, and when it comes to an option, do I feed my kids or take my pills? I'm going to feed my children.
Yeah, or, you know, maybe you've got family who you have to take in, or they really need the money, or you're just stressed and you forget. And mm-hmm. that's another thing. You know, doctors will often say, well, you need to care more about your health you need to take your pills. But actually, people are caring. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the community are caring about their health, because their health is their kids and their grannies and what's going on in their family life. And so they are attending to their health. It's just not the doctor's priority. And I think
it's not the way the doctor perceives that it should be.
That's right, because those issues aren't seen as in the health domain necessarily by the doctor. Mm. If you get that, you can get your practice software to print it out automatically if it's set up, or you can write CTG on the script if they're eligible and you've signed up to PIP, and then those huge benefits come through in terms of adherence to medication use.
And there's also certain medications for particular conditions where you can get a special authority screen, streamlined screening. Oh, hang on. Word.
Scripts, yeah, that's
go.
Right.
Sorry, so, thank you.
So some medications that used to be on the PBS or actually some that have never been on the PBS for mainstream patients are on the PBS for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, including paracetamol and topical antifungals, which are commonly used, but also oral antifungals are much easier to get. So, for example, oral terbinafine you can get without needing a microscopic sample positive result. I'm just trying to think. There are others as well. So ciprofloxacin ear drops for chronic serous otitis media is another important one.
Yep.
And there are others.
We can put a list of that.
It's important to know what they are.
We'll put a list of that on our show notes, Jeff, so we can actually put maybe some links to your research so our listeners can go and have a little look, little Doris, as we like to call it.
Awesome.
Listen, some of the other research you've written with old Noel, Unky Noel, was around how do you make your Indigenous practice sort of more friendly?
Yeah, okay. So Dr. Noel was Queensland's first Aboriginal medical graduate and came to Inala at the behest of the state government in 1994 to set up an Aboriginal clinic here. And Inala's got a lot of Aboriginal people. I think it's about 5%. It's always been about one of the highest proportions of Aboriginal people in a suburb. And yet only 12 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were attending the general practice when he turned up, and he was like, well, wonder what that's all about. And so he did some interviews with community members, and they said things like, well, you're not very flexible around time, and you talk down to us and don't treat us very well at reception, and you're not very sensitive about kids, and there's nothing in the service we can identify with, and there are no Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people on the front desk. And so he set about addressing all of that. He hired Nola White, the Aboriginal nurse, and some Indigenous reception people, put artwork in the waiting room and culturally appropriate pamphlets and flyers and things, developed links with the community, and got cultural awareness training for all the staff. And he basically, it's just been an amazing journey to be on with him. So he managed to get his own clinic in 2007. And then moved over the road into a centre of excellence, got funding of about $8 million from the state government for stage one. Now there's building two as well. And the service as a whole has over 3,000 regular patients now. So I guess the proof is in the pudding, and he's gone from 12 to 3,000 by implementing those sorts of measures.
Yep. So basically for our listeners, it might be something as just as simple as putting some Indigenous artwork up, getting some Indigenous-friendly brochures, pamphlets, handouts that you can get. And there's actually some really good links around Indigenous Health InfoNet, and also Queensland Health have some good patient handouts for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as well. And even the triple flag stickers, like we've had that on some of the practices I've worked in. So it's got the Aboriginal and the Torres Strait Islander and the Australian flag all together, and it sort of identifies you as being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander friendly.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that stuff's important, and it sends really important signals. I guess you wouldn't want to just sort of do those things and say, oh, I've done my job. Yeah. Probably the two of the other really important things is, first of all, to identify Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So
yes,
when important. Someone comes in, you don't assume that they're white or Aboriginal just on skin colour. You can have people from the same family, siblings, who look very different in terms of shades of black or white or whatever. And I think the probably most important of all is your attitude. So one of my patients said to me, if I get a whiff of racism, I'm out of there. It's about survival. So I think, an openness and willingness to, be culturally humble and learn from your patients. A good icebreaker is to ask where people are from. So a lot of white people, when they meet each other, will ask about their CV. You know, I often tell people I'm a doctor, for example, rather than that I was born in Brisbane and brought up here. Whereas you see Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people meet each other and they'll ask where they're from, where their family's from, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, because it's really important for us, because we, work out, where we're from and what part of the world, what tribal group we belong to, and whether we're related somehow. Because that just, or we know somebody who's related, because it helps us identify our family as well, which is really important. So you sort of touched on a little bit, and I was going to ask you a question around being a white fellow doctor working in an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clinic. quite often our registrars will ask me questions around, you know, those potentially awkward consults where it might be like, oh, do I make eye contact with Aboriginal people, or if I'm a male, can I do a pap smear? Like, how do you navigate those potentially awkward parts of a consult?
Oh, look, I think the eye contact is one of those old chestnuts, isn't it? I mean, I think in an urban practice, yeah, I mean, I guess you might not have the direct questioning approach you might have in a white consult. Perhaps you might sort of be more tolerant of silences, and you might sort of walk around an issue for a bit longer before, you know, getting to the heart of a matter maybe. Because I think sometimes that can be a better approach. But, you know, you take it as it comes. People from all over come to our service from all over the state and have all sorts of different upbringings, and I think you just have to take that as it comes. So the eye contact one is just like, yeah, it's not something that really comes up a lot. You can sort of work out whether, you know, it might be in the back of your mind as something to think about, but...
And go off the cues.
Yeah, that's right. You go off the cues for the person in front of you. I think the general thing is to remember to be, you know, really humble generally. I think the big issues, certainly you brought up pap smears. So women's business, men's business is a really important issue. I haven't done many pap smears, if any, recently, though there is cervical self-testing, which has been an awesome intervention. Means that I can actually participate in this world again. I've been getting pap smear results back, or cervical screening test results back, which has been really great. And I think the other really important issue is around child safety. So the state, I work in a state-run organisation, the Inala Indigenous Health Service is run by the Queensland Government. And the state has been involved in removing a lot of children from Aboriginal families over a long period of time. And I think we have and continues to do so. And in some of those situations, it's by any measure appropriate. But I think we need to be really careful about how we deal with those sort of situations. You know, we've got this mandatory reporting obligation, of course, but we also have to sort of take into account where people are coming from. And I'll often ask a cultural mentor before I go to child safety. So you've got to be perhaps a little less rigid about that. And it's not to say that you ignore issues of child neglect or child abuse or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that for a moment, but there can be nuances in these situations, and it's really important to handle the reporting in a safe way and talk to a cultural mentor before going down that road, if at all possible.
And so it's also really important that, you know, a lot of people, I mean, you're very lucky where you are that you actually have direct access to a cultural mentor. So, you know, I think it beautifully leads me to my last question I was going to ask you about today, Jeff, is how do you connect with local community? So if you're a doctor who works in a non-Indigenous medical clinic, how are you going to find a cultural mentor? You know, so I think it's important that we know how to engage with our community. So can you share some tips for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I'm not maybe the best person to ask because
Jeff.
All around me.
Come on, mate.
Well,
I've talked you up. Don't let me down.
So in my case, I've engaged with the Nala Wongra, which is the local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisation. You know, I think you go to the NAIDOC celebration that's in your suburb, nearest to you. You get to know who the local elders are in your suburb, get to know the Aboriginal families in your suburb, talk to the Institute of Urban Indigenous Health. They're all over Brisbane. They would probably know who the important people were in your suburb. Find out who the local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations are. There's, you know...
And even through your PHN.
It's not that hard to find.
The PHN.
Yeah, PHN, that's a really
the Close
idea.
The Gap team, because they're actually somebody who can help you out with the cultural education as well that you need to do to qualify for the PIP payments for the 715s.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you don't have... if you've sort of got an interest, okay, it may not come right to your door, but if you've got an interest to go and pursue this, it's not hard to find the resources, and PHN's a great idea.
And another thing I did is in one of the non-Indigenous health medical services I worked at, we actually invited the local elders around to the fish and chip shop that was just around the corner, and we put on a bit of a feed for them and sat down and had a yarn and sort of said, you know, what would you like to see in a medical practice, and, you know, we're here to help you we'll bulk bill you and here to support you, and they were, you know, really grateful for that sort of stuff. So that's always, yeah, like we'll come for a feed and a cup of tea. No problem.
That's fantastic. So, I mean, yeah, I think something like that's a really good idea.
So, and I really firmly agree as well to go to those local community events. So, you know, you can have a look on, so GPTQ will have a, we've got a Indigenous community events calendar every year. So you can actually look on and see, you know, what are the particular special days, like when's NAIDOC week and when's, you know, the day we celebrate the apology. And then go to the park and hang out with the mob, I think, is the best way to move forward.
Well, the Murray Grapevine is very powerful. So if you become known as a safe GP who's interested in the community, who's going to provide good care, then people will come and see you.
Yeah, exactly. So, Geoffrey, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us today. I'd love to be able to put some of your research, and if you've got some information on your 715 questions, perhaps, I don't know if you've got something like that, but we could put it up on our case notes or show notes that people can access.
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure, Danielle.
Excellent. So we'll get in touch with you, Geoff. But again, thanks. Any final words, any tips for our GPs or our registrars?
Oh, I think Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health is a really rewarding thing to get into. We're working in Australia. It's a really important group. It's a really good thing to be engaged in.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Geoff. And thank you for the work you do again, mate. You're a good fellow.
Thanks, Danielle. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, cheers, Geoff. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.